Okay, the court calls United States v. Cooper, certified issue, government issues. Government, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Baker, judges of the court, may please the court. My name is Captain John Riesenberg, and along with Major LeJean White, who represents the United States in this matter. The military judge abused his discretion in suppressing the accused's confession by, one, applying the wrong law when he failed to apply Oregon v. Bradshaw after finding suspect or initiation of the facts of the case, and, two, making a ruling as to involuntariness predicated on clearly erroneous findings of fact and improper involuntariness of fact.
Counsel, before you get into your arguments, I have a question as to Article 76C. And it's my understanding that the Court of Criminal Appeals in this case set aside the military judge's decision because it felt there were inadequate facts on which it could rule. And we've approved that that type of an action before in United States versus Lincoln. It then said that it was making no decision at all as to the motion to suppress. And Article 76C says that we can only act as to findings on sentence as affirmed or set aside as incorrect in law by the CCA. Now, what findings did the CCA find were incorrect as a matter of law that would give us jurisdiction to hear this case?
The CCA found that the military judge properly applied Michigan v. Mosley to the facts of the case.
Okay, and I will concede that that appears to be a legal issue that they did, in fact, rule on. Putting that aside, what else is there? Your other two issues, I guess, is what I'm asking about.
The basis for the certification was that they applied the wrong law in Michigan v. Mosley, and that the CCA did not act or did not respond as far as the involuntariness of the accused confession. They didn't rule on that, nor did they rule on the third certified issue. I think under Article 67.
The government could certainly certify issues, but it may be that as those issues come up to this court, they're not ripe for us to rule on. And I'm just wondering why we don't just let this procedure work its way out, and you guys can come back up and make the same arguments when there's no question.
Well, if this court has the power to hear these issues as a matter of law under Article 67, it seems in the interest of judicial economy and to prevent piecemeal litigation for this court to hear all of those matters of law now, as opposed to letting these matters work their way through the system, which there might be multiple.
But you're asking us.
Go ahead.
You're asking us to rule on the military judge's rulings in issues 2 and 3,
yes, sir,
without the benefit of having the Court of Criminal Appeals make a ruling on that as a matter of law. And I'm just wondering where we get the ability to do that. And I understand your judicial economy arguments. I'm talking as a matter of jurisdiction.
I think the court has the power to do that under Article 67. And the position is, as far as all of those three certified issues are matters of law, that this court has the power to hear and should hear all of those issues now, so as to avoid what the government
says. They're matters of law, counsel, but issues 2 and 3 are matters of law that the CCA has acted on.
That's correct.
I mean, you agreed with Judge Urban that the only matter of law that you can even tease out of what the CCA did has to do with certified issue law.
That's correct.
So I think Judge Urban's point is if the only issue that we can have any authority to look at is the first issue, why are you coming up here with piecemeal litigation when the whole thing can be resolved together at a later time when you don't even know what's going to happen once they do the additional fact finding?
That's fair, Your Honor. The government's point is merely that in order to avoid any of the potential of later piecemeal litigation and future possible government appeals or any sort of appeal, that this court handle all three matters
at
this time. In that event, Your Honor, I'd like to address the first certified issue, if that is properly before the court, if that is possible. The government's position is...
Let me just be clear. Are you conceding that the other two issues are not before the court at this time, or what is your position?
The position is you'd have to brief that further, Your Honor. I'm not sure. I do not know whether the second and third certified issues are. And they are matters of law, certainly, whether they're properly before this court. I'm not sure. Regarding the first certified issue, the threshold question here in this case is who reinitiated discussion of the investigation following the accused invocation of his right to remain silent. And whenever an accused unequivocally invokes his right to remain silent, any further discussion of the allegations in the case is going to be reinitiated by one of two parties, either the accused or by law enforcement. And the law coming from the Supreme Court is clear that if it is law enforcement that reinitiates, then the courts are to apply the standard in Michigan v. Mosley and look to those procedural safeguards and those protections that exist and our controls on law enforcement allow the suspect to control the time and the duration and the subject matter of subsequent interrogation. Whether the police reread the suspect's rights, whether there's a break in time or a break in passage of time between the first interview and any second subsequent interrogation.
Why does it matter as to whether it's Mosley or Edwards that applies? What is the delta that you get? Why does it matter whether it's Mosley or Edwards that applies?
Because
in terms of legal outcome, not in terms of factual predicate.
The legal outcome of Edwards and Bradshaw, if applied to this case, is what the military judge did not do, is apply that test, which is after bona fide suspect reinitiation. The next question in the Bradshaw test is whether or not waiver was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
So the and Mosley, what is the next question?
The next question is whether or not the law enforcement scrupulously honored the accused invocation of his right to remain silent. Looking at those factors which are directly related to law enforcement reinitiation, whether the cops reread his rights, whether the cops waited a certain period of time between the first interrogation and the second.
Under the Mosley test, does Mosley look to the totality of the circumstances?
They do, sir.
Why wouldn't one of those circumstances be who reinitiated what?
I think as soon as you have suspect reinitiation, you come outside of the Mosley framework. And you are now in the Oregon v. Bradshaw framework. And although that's a right to counsel case, courts have repeatedly applied that to the right to remain silent context when the suspect reinitiates. Because when the suspect reinitiates, it is the suspect that controls the timing, the duration, and the subject matter of the interrogation. And you don't have that concern that the police are coming back to the suspect, trying to break down his resistance and force him to waive his right to remain silent. Because the military judge did not apply the proper framework, he wrongly believed that the question of whether or not there was a break in contact or a passage in time, and the question of whether or not what Special Agent Swerick said to the accused following suspect reinitiation amounted to interrogation, were dispositive factors that controlled the outcome of the case. But because he applied the wrong law, he missed the analysis. And courts have regularly applied the Oregon v. Bradshaw framework to the suspect reinitiation cases in the right to remain silent context, even though Oregon v. Bradshaw is a right to counsel case. And that includes the federal circuits, the Sixth Circuit, the 11th Circuit, the 10th Circuit, and the First Circuit, as well as Illinois, Florida, and Virginia. Now, as a historical factual matter, the military judge got it correct with regard to the first certified issue when he said that near concurrent with the invocation, the accused again asked about the allegations against him. That's on page 2 of the military judge's ruling.
In the government's view, if the Mosley per se, Mosley scrupulously honor test is applied, I understand that's not your position, but if that were your position, is that a per se rule, or does one then ask, nonetheless, is the statement, any statement that is made voluntary?
The Mosley test is separate from the waiver test. At least that's how most courts have applied it. The Mosley test looks to, are the police scrupulously honoring the accused right to remain silent? So we're looking to see what the police action was in the law enforcement reinitiation context.
And my question is that a yes or no answer, and then you suppress, or not? Or is that a yes or no answer, and then you move on to whether any statement is voluntary?
If it is a no, the police did not scrupulously honor the accused right to remain silent, you suppress. If it is a yes, the law enforcement did scrupulously honor the accused right to remain silent, you then look to waiver. At least that is the way that most of the courts have handled it. But here, in this case, the military judge did not look to waiver properly as the second prong of the Oregon v. Bradshaw test.
I apologize to you. I've not read the military judge's ruling per se, but just what's in the briefs. But didn't he find that the CID agent's testimony was not credible?
He only found that it was not credible with regard to a very limited portion of her testimony. The CID agent at the 39A session testified that when the accused reinitiated and said, I don't want, right, I want to talk about the allegations that the daughter is making about me. And after he wrote no on the backside of the 3081, she said that what he said to her was that, no, I don't want a lawyer. The military judge did not find that very limited specific piece credible in regard to what the accused said to her, no, I don't want a lawyer. But that was the only lack of credibility finding as far as the police were concerned. The military judge found the accused credibility to be lacking throughout the rights, warnings, and waiver process. However, the military judge adopted as a factual matter the rest of the testimony that the agent, especially the swearer, had given with regard to the certified issue.
Well, can't you at least argue that the CID interrogation technique violates Article 31?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. Although we're certainly...
They got identity of Cooper, right? Before they gave him his rights.
I'm sorry, say that part.
They established his identity before... Yes. They established his relationship to the victim before they advised him of rights. They established the location of where he lived and where the victim lived before they advised him of his rights. Isn't all that incriminating?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Oh, you don't think that's incriminating?
No, I don't believe there was any part of that, and the military judge doesn't find that any part of that prior to suspect reinitiation was, in fact, interrogation. So there's no finding here that at any point in time between when they began to have their rapport building session and until the time of suspect reinitiation, that any of that was interrogation. It's not until after suspect reinitiation that the military judge finds that what she said to him after he reinitiated and said, what is she saying about me, amounted to interrogation. And we believe he was wrong about that as well.
The rest of it's just conversation?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's what the military judge found, that that was not questioning under Article 31, but just a rapport building session. But because he was applying Mosley, he thought that the question of whether or not that amounted to interrogation was dispositive, because whether or not the police interrogate after indication of the right to remain silent is an important factor in Mosley, but it is not dispositive if you'd apply the correct law under Oregon v. Bradshaw. And we know that from Christopher in the 11th Circuit, which says that suspect reinitiated conversation is not interrogation. And we also know that from Velasquez in the 3rd Circuit, which says that after the first prong of Bradshaw is satisfied, after you have actual suspect reinitiation and the suspect evidencing a generalized willingness to engage in a discussion about the investigation itself, then interrogation is permitted. After interrogation, you have the second prong of the Bradshaw test, which is whether or not waiver is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
Okay, didn't the judge find, among other things, that the accused was under the influence of drugs, exhausted and in pain? Did he abuse his discretion making those findings? Wasn't there testimony to that effect?
He did not abuse his discretion with regard to the fact that he was on pain medication.
But there's more than on being on pain medication. He's in pain. He's exhausted. And he's under the influence of the pain medication.
Well, we don't know what the pain medication was because the military judge doesn't say what the pain medication was. And there's no evidence that this pain medication made him susceptible in any way to interrogation or unable to waive his rights.
Well, he made those findings, did he not?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
And we're not saying those are clearly erroneous. With regard to the second issue, we're saying what was clearly erroneous was his findings that there was a denial of pain medication. Because those facts are completely unsupported by the record.
That when they give it to him?
They did not give it to him because he didn't ask, Your Honor. There was no evidence in the record that a request was made, let alone evidence that a request was denied multiple times, as the military judge says, by Special Agent Kapunis, the second interrogating agent, saying, we will take care of it later. Those facts are completely absent from the record. And that's why, with regard to the second issue, the voluntariness issue, or at least in part, why that was an abuse of discretion.
Okay. Counsel, I'd like you to look at something and be prepared to respond on rebuttal, okay?
Yes, sir.
This is originally a government appeal under Article 62, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the reason was that there was an order that excluded evidence that was critical to your case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. And the CCA, when they looked at it, didn't agree or disagree, they sent it back for additional fact-finding, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So at this point in time, that interlocutory issue is in a period of suspense, correct?
It's
undecided?
That's correct, Your Honor.
When I look at Article 67, it appears to me that it says that we can act with respect to findings and sentence set aside or affirmed or set aside, whatever the language is. Affirmed or set aside by the CCA. We don't have a finding or sentence affirmed by the CCA or set aside, do we?
You do not, Your Honor.
So basically, you have to I believe that in order for us to answer any of your questions, you have to show how this is still a live Article 62 issue. Do you understand my point?
Yes, sir.
So can you be prepared to address that?
Yes, sir.
Turn on rebuttal. Thank you.
You'll have time on rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court. I am Lieutenant Colonel Pete Cagliari, and along with Colonel Patricia Hamm, we represent the appellee in this case, Sergeant Eric W. Cooper. As to issue one, the undisputed fact that Sergeant Cooper invoked his right to silence and not his right to counsel should determine the answer to that issue. The military judge and the Army Court were correct to apply Michigan v. Mosley to the facts of this case. When a suspect such as Sergeant Cooper invokes his right to silence, Mosley requires a military judge to determine whether the police interrogator scrupulously honored that invocation. That scrupulously honored test is a flexible totality of the circumstances type analysis, which allows for the factor of who initiated what, which conversation as one of those factors. Beginning with Miranda, courts have distinguished between the procedural safeguards triggered by a request to remain silent.
Okay, he invokes his right to remain silent. Then he immediately pops off with, now what's my daughter saying about me? Where does that leave us?
It leaves us with the scrupulously honored test, Your Honor.
The scrupulously honored test is basically, wasn't it scrupulously honored by the agent saying, I can't tell you. You just invoked your right to remain silent. I can't talk to you.
And the military judge addressed that issue, Your Honor, under a totality of the circumstances type analysis, where he found that he initiated the same conversation that they had been having. It was one continuous interrogation. He also specifically found that...
Well, then there's no right to silence because he hasn't invoked it. If it's one continuous conversation with a blip on silence, which then rattled on with his consent, then what have you got?
I may have misspoken, Your Honor. It was one continuous interrogation.
One continuous interrogation. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
So he says, I invoke my right to silence. Okay. All right. And then he immediately turns around and asks her a question on the facts of the case.
Right.
Where are we?
Yes, Your Honor. And the military judge found that her response was, in effect, a quid pro quo. I'll give you the information you want if you give me the information I want.
Okay. Is this case De La Rosa, and if not, why? Why not?
It's not De La Rosa, Your Honor, because De La Rosa was an ambiguous invocation case. The military judge cited De La Rosa as being informative as to how a police officer could scrupulously honor the right to remain silent. For example, as this court has pointed out in it depends on where the interrogation takes place, or the second interrogation, when it takes place, whether or not there's a re-advisement, none of which was present in this case.
Okay. What could the agent have done once he invoked the right to silence the first time? What could she have done to scrupulously honor it?
She could have stood up and walked out of the room. She could have sat there and stared at him and said nothing.
Okay, if he then asks her, what's my daughter saying about me, what could she, should she just sit there mum?
She could, Your Honor.
She could have. What could she say that would scrupulously honor it?
You just
that is different from what she said.
Yes, Your Honor. She could have stopped at, I can't speak with you because you just invoked your right to silence.
She right.
She stopped right there, as opposed to adding in the second part, unless you are willing to give me the information I want, essentially, is what the bill
What's the form suggest she do?
I'm sorry, Your
What
Honor.
Does the form suggest she do?
The form suggests, Your Honor, that she turn the form over and have him sign the non-waiver portion.
Did she do that?
No, she didn't, Your Honor. She turned it over and had him sign the waiver portion instead. And so that leaves left the military judge, and that leaves this court with the question of what did she do to scrupulously honor his invocation of his right to remain silent. And the answer I think, is she did nothing to scrupulously honor him. Instead of scrupulously honoring his right to remain silent, she responded with a tactic in order to try to convince him to change his mind on his right to remain silent.
In the abstract, can someone not scrupulously honor the right to remain silent and yet end up with a voluntary statement?
Yes, Your Honor. I think if they failed to scrupulously honor his right to remain silent, and say, for example, there was a break in time, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and they came back in and re-advised, that might allow, and then if the suspect changes their mind and decides to speak, at that point, a judge may find, under the totality of the circumstances, that the suspect or that the police officers scrupulously honor. And that's the advantage of the Mosley approach to the approach that is advocated by the government in this case. The Mosley approach allows for a flexible analysis of all the factors, as opposed to creating some bright-line rule, which, frankly, is not in the law at this point when it comes to right to remain silent cases.
Do you have a response to the questions earlier regarding whether and what this court should address at this time?
Yes, Your Honor. We looked at that issue, and we decided to view it more as in a typical Article 62 case where you're piercing through the CCA's decision down to the military judge's decision. We did address the issue tangentially in our brief, where we suggested that it was proper for this court to allow the Army Court to exercise its discretion to return the case to the military judge for additional findings of fact.
I mean, right now, they vacated the military judge's ruling, so what is there for us to pierce through to look at? It's been vacated.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with you, Your Honor. The issue is not right.
Let's be clear once again, then. What is your view with respect to the question?
Your Honor, I have to concede the issue is just not ripe at this point. And again, we looked at that issue and, for whatever reason, decided not to raise it in our brief.
Okay, 2 and 3 are not ripe.
Correct. Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, is issue 1 even ripe? I mean, is there a finding, let me put it a different way, is there a finding or a sentence or a live Article 62 interlocutory issue?
No, Your Honor, there is not. So issue 1 would not be ripe either.
Okay. From the standpoint of the appellee, to be very clear then, it is the view of the appellee that this court not address any of the questions presently before the court?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. However, in case the court does choose to address the issue, Your Honor, if I may continue with the analysis.
You may.
Counsel for the government argued that suggested that the military judge found that there was suspect reinitiation in this case. And that is clearly not what the military judge found in this case. The military judge found, and he used the word perhaps inartfully in his opinion, and he put it in quotes, he said, at that point, Sergeant Cooper initiated a conversation with Special Agent Swart. On the other hand, the military judge was clear that there was only one interrogation. There was no interrogation. So in other words, there was nothing to reopen or reinitiate. And just as a practical matter, that means that he could not reinitiate the interrogation. Who initiates a particular conversation is not dispositive under this analysis. It's a flexible totality of the circumstances type analysis that allows the military judge to consider the fact that concurrent with his invocation of his right to remain silent, he also asked that question. If this court were to adopt a type of per se rule advocated for by the government, on the other hand, it would in fact, in certain circumstances, tie the hands of military judges by creating this per se rule where there is none currently in the law.
What's always troubled me about these cases was a question I heard from Justice Scalia in one of these cases. What is it about you have the right to remain silent that's ambiguous?
Exactly, Your Honor.
And this guy said, I want to remain silent, not ambiguous. But he didn't remain silent. To go back to Judge Stuckey, he started rattling on. What is the investigator supposed to do?
At that point, Your Honor,
I mean, what kind of analysis can you possibly do?
Her duty is to at least recognize that he invoked his right to remain silent. It appears from the record that she either didn't recognize that...
No, it appears that she said, you have invoked your right to remain silent. I can't talk to you. I mean, how much clearer is that?
But she then went on from there to leverage the information that she had used during the rapport building session against him to try to convince him to change his mind as to his invocation of his right to remain silent. So the advantage of the Mosley analysis, Your Honor, again, is that it allows the military judge to take into account the fact that he asked that question concurrent with his invocation of his right to remain silent.
So what are you asking this court to rule?
We would ask this court to rule that the military judge and the Army Court did not err by applying Mosley to the facts of this case, Your Honor.
Even though it's not right.
Even though it's not right, yes, sir.
Yeah. but what does that give us? Is that we hold they did not err in applying Mosley. Now it goes back.
I think it would still have to go back to the military judge for in accordance with the Army Court's decision.
To do what?
The court, of course, chose to do something different.
But if you find if the judge analyzes it under the Bradshaw case or the Edwards case or any subsequent cases from any circuit or state, they're still going to be right where they are, aren't they? The judge is. Unless he finds there was no reinitiation, period, then he's got to suppress.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
But what's his, it's set back to me as a judge. You did it wrong. Do it right. What am I supposed to do? Right that I did wrong.
Well, at that point, if, say, hypothetically, this court decided that he applied the wrong line of cases, then...
Well, if I apply the right line of cases, am I going to get a different result?
I don't know, Your Honor. That's up to the military judge.
Counsel, what do you believe the CCA has asked the military judge to do on remand?
The Army Court has asked the military judge to make specific findings of fact as to whether or not there was a subsequent re-advisement of rights, and if there was a subsequent re-advisement of rights, did he knowingly and intelligently voluntarily waive those rights, Your Honor?
And did they give the military judge the flexibility to address additional questions of law and ask for additional briefing and essentially re-decide the case?
Yes, Your Honor. It's still in the pretrial stages, and they could raise additional motions, and they could discover additional evidence, take additional testimony, and he could decide the issue on completely different grounds. And the Army Court laid all that out in their opinion, at which point the government can then decide, depending on his decision, whether or not they want to reinitiate an Article 62 opinion.
And that was all put right in the opinion, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Now, the opinion cited to by the government on Issue 1, some of them distinguish Mosley on the facts. However, a close reading of each of those cases reveals that, in fact, those courts did apply scrupulously honored analysis. For example, in U.S. versus Thomas Popcorn, which is a First Circuit case from 2007, a few pages after the quoted language from the government, that court says that the admissibility of statements obtained after the person in custody has decided to remain silent depends under Miranda on whether his right to cut off questioning was scrupulously honored. And they talk about the passage of time as but one factor to consider in the totality of the circumstances. Similarly, in U.S. v. Glover, they distinguish Mosley on the facts, but then conclude that based on the specific facts of that case, Glover's right to cut off questioning was scrupulously honored after Glover invoked his right to remain silent. He invoked his right to silence, the officers immediately stopped questioning, and there was a break in time between the invocation and the subsequent questioning. I think that may answer your question from earlier, Your Honor, where an officer may or may not scrupulously honor at the end of one interrogation, but then reapproaches later. And again, that is the advantage of the Mosley scrupulously honored analysis. Similarly, in Davey v. Mitchell, which was a habeas case, that court found that the invocation of the right to silence was scrupulously honored by the officers after the suspect was given four Miranda warnings during a six-hour period. And again, they applied a totality type analysis. So there is no bright line per se rule when it comes to the right to remain silent. The government's argument is essentially, they're essentially asking this court to ignore which right was invoked and apply one factor to overwhelm all the other factors to create a bright line per se rule, and that is just simply not in the law. It was one continuous interrogation. The military judge found that he was in custody the whole time in the same interrogation room, and it was one interrogation and not two. As the court in Christopher pointed out, you can't reopen a thing that has not been closed. Pending any further questions, Your Honor? Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Government, opportunity for rebuttal. Keeping in mind that you have a question already on the table to address.
Yes, Your Honor. The best argument that the government has is that in Article 67C, what the ACCA did was, and this language is in their opinion, they say the decision of the military judge is therefore set aside. So it's our position that in setting aside the military judge's ruling, we still have a live Article 62 appeal that this court can hear under Article 67.
But the ruling was the thing that you appealed because it went against you, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I said the original ruling that the military judge made is the reason that you appealed because it was against you.
That's correct, Your
Honor. And now it's been set aside. So what are you appealing?
We are appealing the application of the wrong law by the...
No, but what thing that's live now are you appealing? I mean, I understand you have an abstract issue and you would like us to decide, but you have no right finally decided issue.
I think you do have a finally decided issue by the Army Court of Criminal Appeals that the military judge properly applied Mosley to the facts of that particular case.
Counsel, we have no idea what's going to happen. It's been sent back to the military judge. I mean, granted, the government can certify issues all day long, and they come up here and they're certified. But you still have to fit it in within the rubric of something that we can decide.
Agreed.
And in this case, it's an interlocutory issue. You have to fit it within Article 62.
Right.
And there's nothing live under Article 62 because it's been set aside. There's nothing for you to complain about right now except for an abstract legal point.
Right, but the government is complaining that the military judge or the ACCA applied the wrong law and that ACCA also...
But we don't know what it's going to do now. His decision that you say he applied the wrong law was set aside.
Well, he's going to, according to ACCA's direction, apply Michigan v. Mosley again on remand. And that's the complaint of the government. Is that...
Well, then, as they said, then you can come and complain at that point in time if he rules against you.
I agree with that, of course, Your Honor. Just the government's position is...
You just want to complain multiple times?
We want to avoid complaining multiple times.
Yeah, right? I mean, doesn't this totally undercut your judicial economy argument?
Well, I think that the point is that we don't want to complain multiple times.
Well, maybe you should complain when the time is right for you to complain as opposed to complaining early and often.
Understood.
Counsel, are there any points you'd like to leave with the court? Anything on rebuttal that you've now had the opportunity to address?
No, Your Honor. The government submits that the military judge applied the wrong law, and so did the Army Court of Criminal Appeals in applying Mosley as opposed to Oregon and Rancho. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted, and we thank counsel, and we'll stand in recess until 10:30. Thank you.